Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
Not to pile on with all the other problems right now, but there's a drought in California. But in a bit of a switch, it's much drier than normal soil that's rampant in far northern California rather than southern California. And up in the far north of the state, Klamath Basin farmers say they're facing the heartbreaking prospect of watching their crops wither because of sharply cut water allocations recently. How resilient is the U.S. food supply? We're finding out right now, and so far things are stabilizing. For now. There is some good news. The spread of virulent Newcastle disease in poultry flocks in Southern California has been contained. We hear from the state's top veterinarian about this. Crop reports, the week ahead in weather, and a lot more. It's all coming up on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. With their water supplies due to run dry by mid-June, California farmers in the Klamath Basin say they face the heartbreaking prospect of watching crops wither. The California Farm Bureau Federation's Ag Alert newspaper reports that farmers planted crops based on an April allocation from the Federal Klamath Project, only to have that allocation cut sharply in May. After a dry winter, project operators reduced irrigation supplies out of concern for protected fish. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey notes a significant pocket of extreme drought coverage over much of the West.
The big problems are in the western United States, and we have a continuous area of drought that stretches from Washington, Oregon, and Northern California east-southeastward through the Four Corners region and onto the High Plains. That is where the vast majority of the nation's drought is as we move into early June. We have six states at this time reporting extreme drought. By far and away, the worst of those six is Colorado, which has almost 20% of the state in extreme drought on June 2nd. And the other states reporting some amount of extreme drought or D3 in early June includes Oregon and New Mexico, both just short of 5% in D3. California, 3% of the state reporting extreme drought. And then we have Kansas at 2.6% and Oklahoma, 1.7% of the state experiencing D3. So those are your worst pockets or most extreme pockets of drought as we move into early June.
According to the National Drought Mitigation Center, California's worst area of drought is extreme drought in the northwestern sector of California, encompassing most of Siskiyou County. The next level down is severe drought, and that's covering an area all the way from the Oregon border down through the Bay Area and east through the Sacramento Valley. Moderate drought covers the rest of Northern California, extending as far down to south of Fresno.
Back in 2011, Kurt Wilkie was doing some drain tile improvements on his farm in Illinois. However, officials from the local Natural Resources Conservation Service stepped in to say they couldn't maintain or farm their land, claiming it contained wetlands in spite of documentation to the contrary. Wilkie appealed the decision to the National Appeals Division, which is a judicial branch of the USDA. The Wilkie family had to appeal the decision four times before getting a ruling in their favor after a multi-year battle.
Finally, both the judge and the National Appeals Division director issued rulings that the government's position was based on conjecture and speculation, that they had ignored facts and evidence, and that their analysis didn't even follow their own rule book and procedures. So that finally resulted in a conclusion of the case in 2017.
An administrative judge recently ruled Wilkie can pursue action to be reimbursed for his legal fees. Wilkie says it's another case that shows the government has to play by its own rules. He also offers advice to other farmers who may find themselves in similar situations.
I would encourage people, if they get into a situation like this, be persistent and get help. In our case, it was just invaluable to have an engineer who understood the wetlands analysis and could help us rebut the government's case. And the other thing is we were able to talk continuously with the state Farm Bureau, and they had a lot of resources. They knew of other cases. They knew of other situations, and they can bring that experience to bear.
Wilkie says the experience with NRCS has been difficult for his family.
For our family, it's just been incredibly frustrating and obviously a very expensive process. But hopefully, because they're willing to have come out in our case, and we can maybe shine a little light on some of the abuses in this whole process, hopefully other people won't have to go through the same thing we did.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Despite the shocks the pandemic has delivered to the food system, the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture says people can continue to rely on abundant food supplies. The California Farm Bureau Federation's newspaper Ag Alert reports that USDA economist Robert Johansson says food markets remain well supplied, and he describes disruptions as temporary and limited. He says the food system has weathered the impact of the pandemic well, although it's hard to predict how conditions will evolve. With more on the roller coaster ride of food prices, here's the USDA's Gary Crawford.
From March to April, the consumer price index for food at the grocery store shot up 2.7%, its biggest upward monthly leap since this song was a hit. Everybody was kung fu. 1974. Not only a questionable year for music, but that was the year I started broadcasting here at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's even more questionable. But anyway, during April, there were lots of big hikes in prices for some major food items.
And some of those increases had not been that large in decades.
That's Agriculture Department economist and food price tracker Gianna Short. The hikes came almost exclusively from livestock products, whose supply channels were disrupted when demand shifted suddenly from the mostly closed restaurant and food service sector to grocery stores. So as far as price increases, one example?
Eggs jumped 15%.
Wow. For meats?
Beef from March to April is up 4.2%. Pork, 2.7%. Poultry is 4.7%. And fish and seafood, 4.9%.
And normally, the monthly price changes for food products are usually in the fractions of 1%. So Gianna Short had been forecasting that grocery store food prices for the whole year would only go up an average of 0.5%, maybe 1.5%, but
we are now expecting those prices to increase between 2% and 3%.
Breaking that down a bit, for eggs, those could cost us on average about 8% to 9% more this year compared to last. For some of the meats,
beef and veal is now forecast to increase between 3% and 4% for the year. That's up from the previous forecast of 1% to 2%.
Pork could cost between 2.5% and 3% more this year.
Poultry is now forecast to increase between 2% and 3%.
Right now, Gianna seems to think the only food group where we might end up paying less than last year would be fresh fruits. And right now,
they are down 1.7% since this time last year.
And should stay that way for the year. But you know, Gianna, things in the food world are still readjusting. So do you think we're going to see another big food price increase when the May inflation numbers come out here?
There is plenty of food being produced on the farm. So it really depends on how well those supply chains are able to flow in terms of getting the food from the farms to the stores. But I don't think we will inherently expect another month of big increases.
She says that's because gradually the food system's adjusting to the new situation, meat processors starting to gear up again. So we'll see if Gianna is right or not when the Consumer Price Index for May comes out on June 10th. But even if things settle down the rest of the year, Gianna is still looking for those overall grocery store food prices for the year to go up 2 to 3%. And if we get up to that 3% level,
that would be the highest since
this song was a hit. Katy Perry. And what year was that, Gianna?
2011.
You are so right. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Here's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with a look at the national weather picture for the week ahead.
From June 9th through the 15th, it does look like a lot of the country is going to continue to experience summer-like weather. Above normal temperatures, widespread across the central and eastern United States. There may be a bit of a push of cool air, however, across the northern and central Rockies, the Intermountain West, and the Great Basin. In terms of precipitation patterns, some of this is speculative because of the uncertainty of what might happen with the tropical cyclone developing over the Gulf of Mexico. But even with that uncertainty, there is an expectation that an area stretching from the Gulf Coast northward through the Mississippi Valley and into the Midwest will be expecting above normal precipitation. At the same time, drier than normal conditions expected across the Northeast and in a large area stretching from California to the southern half of the High Plains.
And yes, it will be warm here, but not unpleasant. For the period of June 9th through the 15th, the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valley can expect sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s to low 90s, overnight lows upper 50s to low 60s. Here's this week's California Crop Report. In Tulare County, row crops were being chopped and harvested rapidly. Almost all fields have been harvested. They're being fertilized and tilled. In other areas, winter small grains, including wheat, were being harvested for silage, as well as cut, dried, and baled. Fields are being fertilized, cultivated for weeds, and tilled for corn, sorghum, and cotton planting. With favorable warm to hot weather conditions, crops in the Greater Valley are doing quite well. Stone fruit orchard development continues. Cherry maturation and harvest is ongoing. Plums and grape vineyards were leaf thinned as fruit size increased. Apple, pear, and kiwi crop growth progressed. Citrus groves were pruned and topped. Nectarine, peach, apricot, Valencia orange, as well as late navel orange picking continues. Grapefruit, lemons, limes, tangelos, and pomelos were packed and shipped. Olive pruning efforts were constant. Strawberry and blueberry crop development maintains ideal size and color. Fertilizer applications were made. Weed spraying continues for many nut orchards. Almond irrigation progressed, and reports of June drop were at minimal levels. The walnut crop appears to be coming along well in some areas of California with preventative fungicide applications. Pistachio insecticide treatments have increased to lessen impact on vulnerable young trees. Summer vegetables are in various stages of growth and continue to be planted and are developing well with the warmer temperatures. In the Sacramento Valley, tomatoes for processing continue to be planted. In San Mateo County, artichokes and peas were harvested. Beans and Brussels sprouts were planted. Onions for dehydration were harvested in Imperial County. Movement of cattle to higher elevation pasture land continues. Irrigated pastures were in good to excellent condition, while non-irrigated pastures began to dry out. Sheep are grazing on fallowed fields. Some bees were moved out of state, while some were placed in kiwi vineyards as well as melon fields for pollination. Don't forget, the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. The United States Department of Agriculture and the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, that's APHIS, is announcing that effective now, they're transitioning their virulent Newcastle disease efforts in Southern California from a response focus to implementing a prevention plan aimed at keeping virulent Newcastle disease from recurring in the region. APHIS has not confirmed any new virulent Newcastle disease cases since February 1st. As a result, the California Department of Food and Agriculture is removing the virulent Newcastle disease quarantine. With more, here's the CDFA's veterinarian, Dr. Annette Jones.
And I'm here today to give what I hope is the last update of virulent Newcastle disease in Southern California poultry. This is a day many of us have been looking forward to for over 2 years. It's the day that we've completed enough tests on a wide enough area over a long enough period of time that we have the confidence to lift the regional quarantine for Newcastle disease and declare freedom from disease. That means Southern California is once again a safe place to raise poultry, and birds can move freely throughout the state. This has been a great achievement for many people, and I want to take just a minute to thank in particular those people who have worked for the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the California Animal Health and Food Safety Laboratory. Hundreds of very dedicated and talented staff have worked for over 2 years to get us to this place. They've given up so much, and every single day that they worked, they were committed to doing their job just a little bit better. But we couldn't have gotten here without the Southern California bird-owning community as well. The investments that the community has made in biosecurity and the sacrifices they have made to stop this disease from spreading, and not only that, but to eliminate the virus from Southern California, has been a wonderful achievement, and they should all feel very proud of themselves. And ultimately, our goal is to never have to place a large quarantine like this in Southern California again. We never want to go through this. None of us ever want to go through this again. That means it's going to be really important that we maintain those good biosecurity practices and we stay alert to issues, because the virus could be reintroduced into any part of the country from Central or South America in the future. But what we want to do is detect it right away, like we did in some other states, like in Northern California and San Diego and a couple of other places. Should it get reintroduced, we want to detect it right away and take care of the problem before it spreads. Because I am positive none of us want to go through this again. So thank you and congratulations.
To guard against the risk of future outbreaks, the prevention plan led by the California Avian Health Education Network will focus on disease monitoring as well as continuing support for biosecurity training. Biosecurity practices do work. They were essential in minimizing virulent Newcastle disease spread to commercial farms in the area. They were used successfully in other poultry disease outbreaks as well. California's many backyard and commercial poultry owners alike must remain vigilant in protecting the health of their birds by ensuring biosecurity protocols are being followed every day.
Commercial poultry operations practice biosecurity measures to prevent diseases like highly pathogenic avian influenza from entering their flocks. University of Nebraska Extension's Brett Kreifel says backyard poultry producers need to make those same considerations, regardless of flock size or type of bird.
Biosecurity is kind of foreign to some of our backyard flock producers. They like to bring birds in intermittently. They like to bring people over to see their hens. They don't realize the implications of doing that if a disease were to come into their flock.
Kreifels adds backyard poultry biosecurity measures include introducing all poultry birds at once and not to mix young and older birds in a flock, monitoring who comes onto property, conducting proper cleaning and disinfecting of equipment, and wearing shoes only meant for work in the poultry flock or coop, changing into those and taking them off before entering or after leaving the work area. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's June. Is rice planting complete? Brad Rippey of the USDA takes a look at the national rice planting picture.
Rice planting for the week ending May 31st, nearing completion in most areas and 93% complete nationally, slightly behind the five-year average of 96%, but ahead of last year's pace. 89% of the crop had been planted by the end of May in 2019. We see rice planting now complete in California, and 98% complete in Louisiana and Texas. One state where planting is languishing, and this is a common theme for a lot of crops in the Northern Delta region, Missouri rice, just 83% planted. Five-year average is 93%. Rice emergence nationally, 81%. Five-year average, 86%. Last year, just 72%. Arkansas, the number one production state, a little bit late on planting, so 81% of the crop has emerged, 91% is the five-year average. Rice condition, though, overall is pretty good, 69% good to excellent. Only 2% of the crop rated very poor to poor. That actually represents a nice jump in condition from the previous week when we saw 62% of the crop good to excellent and 3% very poor to poor. A year ago, rice was rated 61% good to excellent and 7% very poor to poor. The only state with a real issue, early condition numbers, Missouri, 8% of the crop rated very poor to poor.
Here in California, it looks like the rice planting is complete. Rob Dornbos, a Butte County Calrose rice grower at Tendor Farms, says it's complete, but there were some obstacles along the way.
As a rice farmer and a weatherman, I would be remiss if I didn't say a little bit about the weather challenges we had this spring. Whether it was untimely periods of rain or prolonged periods of heavy wind, be it from the north or the south, we had our challenges. But we're really blessed here. We have a great toolkit to fight those challenges, and it all starts with our talented and dedicated crew, a fantastic PCA, rice seed that does really well in a low water environment, which is incredibly important. And lastly, dynamic and robust water supply that we try to be used as wisely as possible, whether in a tactical or a strategic sense. This is 25-day-old calrose. You can see the seed right here. The root development is nice and strong, and according to our calculations, we should start harvest around October 1st.
Total acreage planted in rice in California for 2020 looks to be around 500,000 acres, about the same as last year, but when it's all said and done, it actually might be a little bit more than that.
This fiscal year, China will likely buy more U.S. agricultural products than this past fiscal year, but events over the last few months have
slowed their demand for imports to a certain degree.
And Agriculture Department Chief Economist Rob Johansson says that's reflected in USDA's latest trade projections for this fiscal year's Chinese purchases of U.S. ag products. Johansson says back in February, in dollar terms,
we had forecast them at $14 billion from the U.S., up from $10 billion in fiscal 19, and we have them at $13 billion now, so up from last year, but down $1 billion from February.
But these projections are for fiscal year 2020, which began October 1st, ends September 30. So Johansson says you really cannot connect those projections to the Phase 1 trade agreement commitments, which are on a calendar year basis. And of course, we are not even halfway through calendar year 2020. Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
On-farm prices for California-grown green bell peppers have been sharply higher than a year ago, but farmers say that has more to do with short crops in other regions than pandemic-related changes in demand. Down in the Coachella Valley, farmers say they're harvesting red and yellow bell peppers along with green bells. The California Farm Bureau Federation reports that fewer peppers than expected from Mexico have been reaching market, heightening demand for the California crops.
Congress is considering changes in the next legislation for the Paycheck Protection Program, and the American Farm Bureau seeks corrections that allow farmers to better participate. AFBF Congressional Relations Director R.J. Carney says action will happen soon.
We expect the House to take up a bill this week. The Senate is expected to vote on its bipartisan bill shortly after getting back into session next week. While Farm Bureau is supportive of these bipartisan efforts, Farm Bureau is also asking for additional corrections that would allow agricultural producers to more fully participate in the Paycheck Protection Program.
Farm Bureau wants Congress to allow farmers to increase net farm income on their 2019 Schedule F tax form. Carney says farmers showing a zero or negative net farm income on the form may not be eligible for the program.
Farm Bureau recommends that farmers be allowed to increase their net farm income through all rental income, farm equipment trades, breeding livestock, and other documented sources of income. There's also a lot of uncertainty on how H-2A workers qualify as an employee for the Paycheck Protection Program. Farm Bureau asks Congress to allow all H-2A workers in the United States to qualify for the program when determining the employee count and for purposes of program eligibility.
Carney encourages farmers and ranchers to get involved in the process.
We encourage farmers and ranchers to contact their members of Congress and share their stories about the concerns they have for the Paycheck Protection Program and what changes are needed so they can fully participate in the program.
Michael Clements, Washington.
We're coming up to that time when almond growers throughout California will be doing hull split timing and spraying. When the almond hulls start splitting, that's the time to spray to stop the spread of navel orangeworm damage. Good almond growers know there are two key points. Don't wait too long to start hull split spraying or it's going to cost you, and so will a poor spray job. How do you do a thorough spray from a ground sprayer? According to Franz Niederholzer, he's the farm advisor for Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba counties, he says drive that tractor slow, real slow.
Yeah, two miles an hour is a good target, you know, a little bit less. We did some work with Joel Siegel and Nichols with Ken Giles 10 years ago. The difference in coverage between 1.8 and 2.5 miles an hour was dramatic. I'm not recommending that, you know, the 1.8, but growers should check their orchard, the size of your sprayer fan, and the power that you're using to move air and spray into the canopy. It's got to get matched up with the trees. And if you've got a great big sprayer with double fans and, you know, 2 miles an hour is still a pretty good general rule. You can check it, but most growers check your airflow and check your spray coverage with water-sensitive paper and flagging, but you know, most growers have quit spraying, so it's a very dense canopy, slows down your airflow quite readily, and it's remarkable how difficult it is to get good coverage in the treetops.
Niederholzer points out that naval orangeworm damage and hole rot pressure have increased in the last few years. Proper spray timing and delivery will help make reading that rejection sheet less painful and almond growing more profitable.
What is the current state of organic agriculture in this country?
We continue to grow both conventional and organic carrots, but every year the consumption of conventional carrots continues to go down and organics is taking its place.
That was Jeff Huckabee with California-based Grimway Farms.
And I deal with almost every major retailer in the nation, and every time I go and have a meeting with them, we do not talk about conventional anymore. Every question and everything they ask is about organic.
Dairy is another industry about which organic producers are optimistic, despite some less than encouraging news.
Fluid milk consumption over the last 30 years has declined readily and steadily. And there's no question. We can't deny the data on that.
Bob Kirschhoff is with the dairy co-op Organic Valley.
Where we find and we still have opportunities is we're delivering our promise to our consumers around our authenticity and transparency.
Both men spoke on a panel at USDA's recent Agricultural Outlook Forum, along with the Economic Research Service's Catherine Green.
On the market share, milk still the big one in terms of market share. 18% is what ERS has calculated, followed by, again, the animal product, fresh eggs at 12%.
Her numbers came from the 2017 Census of Agriculture.
Fruits and vegetables still increasing their market share at retail at 7% and 8% after all these decades. This is the sector that got started in the 70s. This is what I saw in cardboard boxes in natural food stores. And even this industry is still on the upswing.
That is followed by chicken pieces.
I would say growth in poultry production has followed the growth in produce and dairy, and it's still kind of in a fast momentum right now.
Panelist Corin Heatwall saw opportunity in organic poultry. He founded Shenandoah Valley Organic in 2014.
With a mission of promoting and protecting generational family farms, our model's like taking a step back in time to when farmers owned the chickens in the barns, but yet with incorporating modern technologies so that we can make that product available and also affordable.
From the 2012 to the 2017 Censuses of Agriculture, overall farm sales of organic crops and livestock products in this country more than doubled in value from $3 billion to more than $7 billion.
And dairy doubling to $1.5 billion. Poultry and eggs growing fivefold in that five-year period.
With fruits and vegetables.
Even after decades of growth, we're still seeing between the last two censuses, the sector doubling to over $3 billion.
And in other commodities.
Grains and oilseeds, it's still kind of small, but it did double in that period. Same thing for most of the other sectors that are smaller. The only sector that had only a very modest amount of growth was beef cattle. Beef cattle and other cattle are still the tiniest sector.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You may not realize it when you go to your local supermarket here, but supermarkets are fighting to stay relevant and stay in business against a flood of new competition for our food dollar. In other words, as the Randy Newman song says,
it's jungle out there.
It's a very tough business out there.
And we'll find out how tough it is for supermarkets and what they're doing to cope and compete on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Once upon a time, in an era long, long ago, before 1916, there were no self-service grocery stores, let alone supermarkets. A shopper would go into a store and they might ask the clerk,
I want 10 pounds of kumquats, and I'm in a hurry.
Kumquats, yes. Yeah. Then, in 1916, a fellow named Clarence Saunders opened up the first Piggly Wiggly store in Memphis, in which astonished customers were given a basket and told to roam around the shelves and pick out their own stuff. This novel idea caught on with shoppers, but even into the 1930s, shoppers in most places would go to a butcher shop for meat, a fresh produce store or cart for fruits and veggies, another store for shelf-stable items like flour or canned goods. But then the idea of putting all of that in one store began to spread. So, 1933, the term supermarket was first coined. 1937, the shopping cart was invented. That really helped things. And by the 1950s, supermarkets were kings of food retailers. Really no competition except from other supermarkets. But in the last few years. That has certainly changed, and supermarkets are having to work very hard.
Trying to compete on many different fronts.
And there are so many fronts, including what's been happening with the coronavirus. Now, that was Brian Todd. He's former president, current advisor of the Food Institute, which does all kinds of research on the food retailing business, which he says is definitely
changing every day,
putting supermarkets in a defensive position where they have to change or lose out. There are some bites being taken out of supermarket sales from all directions. More retail businesses are going into grocery sales, nipping away at supermarkets. Drugstores, for example, are putting in more freezer cases, more fresh food sections, and supermarkets are also facing even more competition as we speak from
dollar stores.
And they're taking sales away from local supermarkets, especially in rural areas where more and more people seem to be
popping into a dollar store to buy their milk and bread. Dollar stores have noticed this, so they are expanding their food offerings, adding more freezer cases, more ready-to-eat foods. So we're seeing much more growth in those areas.
And of course, in the more urban areas, we have the beginnings of what Brian Todd calls the meal kit concept. Companies like HelloFresh and others providing home delivery of the ingredients to make entire meals, saving time for meal preparers, also reducing what they need to buy at the grocery store. And as they say on the TV ads, wait, there's more. More competition for our food dollar from restaurants and a major spurt in the number of drinking establishments. Todd says drinking places saw sales up 17% last year.
We figured maybe, you know, with everything that's been happening in the country, people were just drinking more.
But no, they were eating more at the local watering holes.
A lot of the drinking places were increasing their food offerings. This ties into the surge in craft breweries offering food items.
So that's just a taste of what supermarkets are up against. Todd says supermarket sales did grow last year, but by only 2%, which is considered in the industry very low growth, almost no growth.
But retailers are a very creative group of people.
And so, yeah, supermarkets are fighting back, trying to stay in the hunt by
putting in new technology, trying to imitate what the competitor is doing in many ways, trying to squeeze as much out of the dollar as they can.
On the imitation front, the purchase of the Whole Foods grocery store chain by e-commerce home delivery giant Amazon has prompted more supermarket chains to try to get into more e-commerce and home delivery.
There is an expense for the chain in there, but I think they see it as something that they have to do to compete.
Some stores are offering meal kits themselves also. They are revamping their deli sections with more prepared foods there and in other parts of the stores. In other words,
more services for that time-starved consumer because that's what they want.
And we mentioned that supermarkets are also losing sales to restaurants and bars, and so many stores have put in restaurants in their stores, so-called grocerants.
They're making the supermarket more entertaining, trying to keep the people in there as long as possible.
But now, of course, the COVID-19 situation has temporarily sidelined that concept. But some supermarkets are tapping in on other consumer trends, more fresh foods grown by local farmers, more organic products, just anything to try to boost sales and stay relevant in the fast-changing world of food retailing. Because, here we go again.
It's jungle out there. It's jungle out there.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
The Los Angeles Times reported something about Tulare County you might find very interesting. It is the leading agricultural county in California. Beyond that, it's the leading agricultural county in all of the United States. But it also has the highest rate of food stamp participation in California. More than 25% of residents rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, sometimes called CalFresh. It's a participation rate that's more than twice the national average. Only three other California counties have rates above 20%, and all but one of them are in the Central Valley. Well, recently, the federal government announced proposed changes to SNAP eligibility that would close a so-called loophole. Basically, it would make it harder for people in California to get food stamps. Here in California, estimates place the number of households who might lose access to SNAP at 120,000 or more, making it very challenging for all the food banks and those that give assistance to those who are hungry here in California. And there's another complicating factor. With ICE, the immigration crackdown, which has made many farm laborers very reluctant to stand in line at food banks. We're talking with Nicole Celaya. She's the executive director of FoodLink, the only independent food bank in Tulare County. That organization serves all the county and between 300,000 to 400,000 people annually. And Nicole, tell us a little bit about hunger among the farm workers who live in Tulare County. After all, it's a $7 billion industry, and it's ironic and it's sad that these people who are picking the food don't have access to the food.
Yes, thank you. You're absolutely right. It is a very cruel irony that the people that are putting the food on our tables cannot access that food themselves, whether geographically or economically. And so we have, I think, about six different locations geographically here in Tulare County that are designated as food deserts by the USDA. And so most of the people living in those food deserts don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, live really far from any type of grocery store. And so we do our very best to kind of fill the gap there in those communities. And the large population of people in those communities are farm workers. And so, yeah, it is quite sad that these people are not able to access the very fruits and vegetables that they're picking.
Tell us how FoodLink works. How do you get the food to the people who need it?
So we work with about 30 different food pantries throughout the county. And so we deliver them USDA goods, canned and shelf-stable items that they distribute out into the communities. And then we also do our own distributions of fresh fruits and vegetables, as well as a smart pack program that sends kid-friendly packs of food out to about 14 different sites throughout the county every Friday, and so that they have food to eat over the weekends. So we have a lot of different programs that we work on to get the emergency resources out, but we also do a lot of food systems work, and we have a food system alliance where we get together with local community members and other organizations to talk about how we can create a more equitable and sustainable food system here in Tulare County.
One of the issues with the cutbacks in the SNAP program would be the school lunch program, which could see some severe cutbacks, would make it even more important that food is getting into the households of the people who need it if those cutbacks do indeed happen. Is the school lunch program part of what you do?
No, we don't do anything with that. It's a USDA program that the schools administer on their own. But we do supply the summer lunch program, which kind of fills in the gap there for the kids that aren't able to access the lunches during the summer.
Have you seen or heard of stories in the Tulare County area of what has been reported happening over in the Santa Cruz area of farm workers afraid to come out to the food banks and pick up the food for fear of immigration raids?
Well, there has been a very big ICE presence here in Tulare County, and people are just scared in general. But we've been working very hard for the past few years to make sure that the people that access our services feel safe. And so we make sure that we have signage out that they know that their information is only for our own purposes. It'll never get sent out, that will protect them from ICE if ICE shows up. And then we also do training with all of our pantries as well to make sure that they are keeping their own clients safe. So, you know, our numbers have not gone down. In fact, they've continually grown over the past few years. And so I think it's just because most of the residents know us and know that we're going to protect them. But it is a definite fear for a great majority of our population.
So you are not a governmental entity. How do you get your support?
Right. We're a totally independent food bank. And so we do get support from the USDA through commodities and also through some monies that help us with capacity and with overhead. But for the most part, we rely on donations and fundraising and, people power.
Have you seen any cutbacks from the USDA?
Yes. Oh, yes. Steadily every year, the amount that we're able to get from them as far as money to help support operations, that steadily goes down every year.
Now, we've heard about food organizations in California that actually collect the unpicked food from farms. Do you do anything like that?
We do. We work with a really great organization called Harvesting Hope under the arm of United Way. And local youth get together and go and glean either in large orchards or just backyard trees that people can't where people can't handle the fruit, and then they will deliver it to us.
Recently, on your website, on your blog, you talked about food justice and food security and what should be done. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's part of our Deep Roots program, where we educate people on food justice and what it means and what it can look like for our communities. And so, food justice for us, it kind of has a three-pronged approach. that helps to guide the work and the action that we do. So food security is obviously, you know, people being able to access food, the food that they need at all times. And the food insecurity right here in Tulare County is about 15%, but it jumps up to 30% in households with children. So that's the first prong. And then the second one is food equity, which says that everybody should have equitable access to food. And so we know that, you know, people with disabilities, people, especially the senior population, they have a much harder time accessing food, the food that they need, than other populations. And then the last prong is food sovereignty. And we want to make sure that people are able to take control of their food system and to be able to grow their own food and sell their own food and do what they need, so that we are not at the whims of an inequitable food system.
Tell us a little bit about FoodLink. How can people get in touch with you, find out more about the organization?
So FoodLink, we're located in Exeter, California. But like you said, we serve all of Tulare County. And people can visit us on social media, Facebook, FoodLink for Tulare County, or you can go to our website, foodlinktc.org, and see what we do. You can donate there. You can sign up to volunteer. You can get more information on our programs, as well as if you need to access emergency resources here. So there's plenty of ways to get a hold of us.
Nicole Celaya, the executive director for FoodLink, serving 300,000 to 400,000 people annually to make sure that they get the food that many of them are picking for the rest of us. Nicole, thank you so much for a few minutes of your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at kste.com.